Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out. Say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And, I don't know, let's start with the sad so we can move on.
To the wild and inappropriate.
I don't even want to give the idiot in chief's comments like any, like I actually didn't even like feel the, like I want to say something about it, but like it's just another voice in the, you know, and really it's an attention seeking thing anyway. Mm-hmm. So giving the, it's a badly behaved child, right? Like giving them the negative attention is still attention. So, fuck him. Like that's where we both stand. So when I will say this, when James Woods, it's like, there's nothing negative we can say about this man. He was a lovely person, a great American, and this is a horrible tragedy. And of course, we're talking about the death of Rob Reiner. Rob Reiner. I almost said Carl Reiner, who died a while back. Rob Reiner and his wife. And it, like presumably, seemingly at the hands of their child.
Whose life was was troubling to say the least, unfortunately.
Seeing pictures of him from when they were doing press for the film that they made together, which was kind of autobiographical.
But, yeah.
And pictures of him now, it is, and that wasn't that, it was 10 years ago that they made that movie, which I've never seen. Like, I know Rob Reiner had kind of fallen out of, like, Hollywood royalty from a director standpoint, at least. Producing, I mean, he still had it. Like, it was, it's just tragic, man. It's just so fucking tragic. And watching it as somebody who has a sibling who has a lifelong, or has had up to this point, a lifelong like battle with drug and alcohol abuse. And seeing my mother like still try to be a mother to that person. And like, I understand that desire, like no matter what, and like you can find interviews where Rob Reiner's talking about it, like, this is my son and I love him and I want to help him. And I don't know, so this is all just, I guess, speculation, but do you think we'll ever know what that was about? Why? Like, because he's not issued, I mean, right, I mean, it would be stupid for him to make a statement, but yeah, I don't know. I'm rambling. It's still, every day, it's still just like hitting me. Not that he's dead, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just kind of went through something similar with Gene Hackman and his wife, but that wasn't a murder. Two people dying tragically, hopefully not too far apart from each other, because of weird circumstances. This is a murder, and not even a like, oh, there was a home invasion, a botched robbery, or just you got into an argument with your kid and he killed you, seemingly.
Yeah, I honestly don't know if we're ever going to find out what the real truth of the situation was. I mean, we've heard about the party that he was at. I think it was Jimmy Kimmel's party. And
Conan.
Oh, Conan. That's right. Conan. He was at Conan's party and there was a huge argument. It could be something as simple as money. Like, you know, because he dealt with, like, you know, he dealt with drug addiction. He dealt with mental illness. Those two do not go well with one another. As anybody who has had somebody that in their life that, like, with drug addiction or with mental health issues and drug addiction, it is not a pleasant experience. And I don't know. Like, I honestly don't know. It's truly. To know that this man and his wife died by a stabbing is, like, you don't ever want anybody to go out like that. But for a man who did so much and brought, not just bringing joy with entertainment, but from a perspective of, like, giving and donating not only his time but his money to causes.
For things that he believed in. Like, even if you disagree with his politics, like, this was a guy who backed up the shit that he preached.
Exactly.
Like, this was not, you know, platitudes. It was not, you know, and that's partly probably led to him kind of not being like that director in Hollywood anymore, because his attentions were less on, like, oh, I've got to make that movie that everybody's going to talk about, and more about, like, this shit doesn't matter. Like, I want to make something that says something that matters, you know. Not that all the stuff he did said something and mattered, but it was, you know, once that's not what people are looking for, it's like, oh, well, go make a superhero film, Rob Reiner. Like, yeah, like, he has no interest in that. So, no. You know, and just from, like, a standpoint of, like, geek culture, it's been posted everywhere, but there will never be anyone. I mean, I don't think, like, not even Spielberg. There will never be anyone that has a run like Rob Reiner. And I don't know. I feel like we've probably had this conversation before.
We've had like because we talked about him, because you cannot talk, like, you cannot not talk about him when it comes to Stephen King. Like, he has directed, like, okay, so, like, he's directed or produced probably the top three King adaptations, in Shawshank, which he produced, Misery, and Stand By Me.
Wanted desperately to direct.
Yeah.
See, that's another thing. Sorry, I cut you off.
No.
This is a man who, like, read Shawshank, saw a script for Shawshank. Like, he saw the vision. And then once he could get to where he could direct it, it was in somebody else's hands. And he was happy to just be part of the process to bring it to life.
Yep.
And beyond the King stuff, I mean, so 1984 to 1992.
Yeah.
Spinal Tap, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men. And honestly, if you take out North in 1994, you have The American President and Ghosts of Mississippi. And I would need to go back and rewatch it, But I remember watching The Story of Us when it came out and found it deeply effective.
It's I recently watched it about 5 years ago. And when I initially watched it, I had the same feeling. When I saw this, it's very, how can I put it? It was written by a sitcom writer, and you can feel the sitcom writer-ness in this.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, it's weird because it has this very kind of, like, Bruce Willis and Michelle Pfeiffer are going to win Oscars for this. Like, that's the kind of, like, that's the kind of, like performative, like, kind of thing. It's not Reiner's fault. Reiner directs it like he always does, like, with a nice Midas touch. But it's the script is just too crass to be. It's like that, you know, like, there's always that one awards contender that everybody loves, and then about 10 years later, everybody goes, ugh. Why? Like, this year I feel it's going to be Hammett, because I saw Hammett and I've not talked about it. But it's a fine movie, but also it's dealing with some really fucking serious shit triggering things. It has a death of a child in it. Like, yeah, spoilers. I mean, like, it's about Hamlet, right? Like, and like, it's basically the dour sequel to Shakespeare in Love. It's like, it's literally Shakespeare. Yeah, Shakespeare in Death. Get married,
have a kid, and yes, then like, the kid dies tragically, and they're never the same. You know, I mean, exactly. It's that's a story as old as stories. But back to Rob Reiner.
Yeah,
But just that 8-year run,
oh, of, yeah, those
7 things, like, are damn near 10-year run if you include The American President and Ghost of Mississippi, and North is the only misstep, then, again, Spielberg doesn't have a run like that.
No, because Spielberg has those big swings and misses.
Yep.
Whereas, like,
even Reiner, if you went to, like, Spielberg's, like, golden age, like, that, yeah, the 10 or 12 year, which, you know, we can talk about him in a second. No matter what you do, if you get into that, like, late 80s, 90s, you're still going to have the Lost World in there.
Yep. Exactly.
And it's not a great movie.
No. Like, well, like, you do the 70s and you have 1941. Or the 90s you have Hook. The 80s you have
is a sentimental favorite, but
yes.
Like, I am with you that it's like, what are you doing?
Exactly. It's very kind of like, huh. But I mean, you know what I mean? Like there, but it's also like, I feel like what people don't understand about Reiner is literally out the gate with Spinal Tap, he invents a genre. The mockumentary and the rock, yeah, the rockumentary were not a thing. And he even says it like, it's so sad because I literally on Saturday watched, you can look at my fucking, my Letterboxd account. I watched the new 4K of Spinal Tap. And he's in the opening moments. And like, this was before I even know, like, you know, this was just a super stupid, sad coincidence that I happened to watch it. Cause I wanted to watch something that I've seen so many times that was pleasant, but I could also ignore and come back to because I know the movie inside and out. And so it was like, oh, new Spinal Tap disc. I'll put it on the 4K. I mean, it looks beautiful. It's gorgeous. But the opening moment, he literally uses the word a rockumentary, if you will, as Marty DeBerge, right? That was never a thing until that movie. He created a fucking genre. Then he goes and reinvents the romantic comedy, like within that run, like, he has both a reinvention and a creation. Like, Spielberg doesn't have that. Nobody has that. Nobody, like, within a 10-year run creates, incepts a genre and then takes a genre that nobody wanted and makes it something that, that became a staple in the 90s. Literally, When Harry Met Sally is the reason why Matthew McConaughey, Kate Hudson, Jennifer Lopez, Meg Ryan herself has a career.
You don't have that absolute, I mean... Rom-coms in the mid 80s to like the late 90s were the superhero genre that we've had since 2000. That's it. Every fucking movie, like every other movie that came out, like it's a rom-com, it's a rom, like that's what we were producing on the level of superhero films was rom-coms, and Rob Reiner is largely responsible for that. Could any other director have made The Princess Bride, which is a perfect film, perfect beginning to end. No notes, just perfect film.
If you really do it, if you do the numbers, he created, he directed three perfect films. Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, and When Harry Met Sally are perfect films from beginning to end. There's no faults in them. There's zero faults. They are perfect films. But I think that if we're taught, Princess Bride is his Wizard of Oz. It's our generation's Wizard of Oz. It's the thing that we all, we're all glad they never made a sequel to. But we all watched as kids. And it somehow became this universal thing for us. And, it's everything that you could possibly want from a movie.
I think my favorite, a top five. I don't know if I could say it's my favorite, but it's damn close though. You Promise Me Money, Promise Me Power, All That You Want and More, I Want My Father Back, You Son of a Bitch, is one of the best fucking scenes ever put to film.
Yeah.
It gets me every single time. Every time. And I don't know. And from the, I talked a little bit about him producing, and, I just saw Jerry Seinfeld live. Not long ago at all.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he said something, because I was one of those people that when the Seinfeld DVD set initially came out, I devoured those special features. And one of the things that was fascinating for me was going back to the early episodes, first season that isn't even a season. It's two seasons and it's barely 13 episodes, I think. They talk about how nobody understood the show. The network didn't want the show. It was just, they were trying to kill it. And Rob Reiner was one of those voices, and because of who he was at the time, who could stand in the gap and be like, there's something here, please just hang on. There's something here. And it is my favorite show of all time. I know there's a lot of people that, because there is not a lot of redeeming quality, but that's kind of the point. It's terrible people
doing terrible things
of their terrible actions. So he was a champion for one of the greatest, what I think is probably the greatest show ever on television. He starred in another of the greatest shows ever on television. The man was just unbelievable, inconceivable.
Exactly.
In his own words. It's just profoundly fucking sad that, you know, that this happened, to be found by one of your, to be seemingly murdered by one of your children, found by another one. I can't imagine. And then I swear to God, if it were me and people were saying that, like, I would have to be offline and indefinitely, probably for the rest of my life, because seeing people like attack him is just, it's so disgusting, man. Like,
yeah,
everybody wants to compare it to Charlie Kirk, and it's just like, okay, I guess maybe, but, you know, just, and I kind of felt this way about Charlie Kirk. Like, I didn't have anything nice to say, so I just didn't say anything.
Yeah. Well, like, so like the weird, okay, so like his last appearance, like, did you know this, that his last, like, this tells me all you need to know about Rob Reiner. Like, everything you need to know about this man. And it's like, and after this, like, when I saw this, I was like, you know what? Fuck everybody that has something, like, anything but the not the nicest things to say to, about him, is that he was on Piers Morgan. And
I saw it. I saw
the interview.
And they asked him what he felt about Charlie Kirk's death. And
it was
profound. It was moving. There was no vitriol there.
No.
You know?
And he was like, if he's like, the most beautiful thing is that Erica Kirk, like, if she truly meant it, like, and she gave, like, you know, her, like, she opted to forgive this man who killed her husband. There's nothing more that anybody can say or do, because she is the one that has to live with this the rest of her life. And I was like, this fucking guy, like, Piers Morgan brought him on because he thought he was going to be able to fight with him. And Rob Reiner was like, hold my fucking beer. Fuck you. I'm not going to let you do that and put me into this little box, because the thing that I know for a fact, and part of the reason why he made Ghosts of Mississippi, is because he abhors gun violence, abhors it. Like, he hates it. Like, he hates violence and all of its thing. And part of the reasons why he made Ghost of Mississippi was because it's about a racist fucking, a racist bigot who murders people, who has murdered somebody, and the after effects of that murder. It's not a perfect film, but I do love the intention of it, because it literally is about the repercussions of violence. And, like, what violence can do to a community. And, like, at the end of the day, it's like, anybody who wants to fucking, like, talk shit about him, you know what? God be with you. Really? Because you're going to have to atone for that. Because this man, he may not have been perfect, but you know what? I've never seen anything out there about him being a horrible human being. Like, he's not sitting out there exposing himself to actresses. Like, some of the fucking directors, like, one who's specifically coming back because, you know, all of his buddies, his billionaire fucking buddies are like, own Paramount and own, like, here's how shitty you have to be, is that they won't make a movie with you at New Line that's super popular, but now all of a sudden, because the rights revert back to you, you can go and take it over to Paramount, and Paramount and your buddy Larry Ellison will make the fucking movie, even though they have to put a dump truck full of money for both Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker to do it. Like, literally, yeah. I've heard that the money that they're offering, that they're both going to be making like something like in the neighborhood of anywhere, like rumors are anywhere between $30 to $50 million a piece. Like that's how, like, I'm not even going to say the guy's name, but he's not this man. This man did nothing like that. He had kids. He had like, he got a divorce. Big deal. Like what people don't have a divorce. And he's never owned up to the fact that he was a piece of shit
but they had been married for a while, right?
Since Harry met Sally. Like he literally met her on when Harry met, like he tells this story and like I also started watching that and it got too emotional for me. Like that was the one that hit me. Like I couldn't do Princess Bride. Like Andre the Giant, him, like the father stuff, Jesus, like it just was like the grandpa, like, oh man, I could not, I don't even know if I've ever told you this. Since my grandfather's died, I've not watched Princess Bride. I can't get through it. I end up a puddled mess because that was me and my grandpa. But anyways, I was watching When Harry Met Sally, and I remembered the story he's talked about how the original ending for When Harry Met Sally that they wrote, that him and Nora Ephron wrote, was that they didn't end up together. And then he met his wife on the movie, and through the course of the movie they fell in love. They became friends and then they fell in love. And then he literally ran to Nora Ephron after they finished filming and he's like, we're gonna reshoot some of the stuff, we need to change the ending, they need to be together. To which Nora Ephron very classically said, I told you that from the beginning. Which is kind of great, because if it doesn't end up together, it doesn't make the movie that we all know and love. Yeah. You know, it's one of the few movies that I feel like earns the togetherness of that couple. Because we see it over the... I mean, you know, there's just so much. But I don't know, man. Like, it... Like, the last thing I saw... Like, I'm waiting for Spinal Tap. It was going to be a little bit too much for me. The last thing I saw of him was... Because I'm a huge fan of Albert Brooks. He directed the documentary, Albert Brooks Defending Your Life. Or Defending My Life. And that's a great documentary. If you love Albert Brooks, it's basically him and Albert sitting there talking about like his career and his life, and intercut with like different people talking about them and different things about different projects and stuff. It's a wonderful doc. Like, it's one of those bio docs, but it's done in such a good way. Like it's done in that way that you don't mind that it takes off the rough edges of who Albert Brooks was, because it's literally that it's two friends going down memory lane, but also talking about their careers. So it's really good.
And I mean, he's the perfect person to do it because they've been friends since what, like middle school or something?
Yeah, it was middle school.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean,
I recently also read a story. This is about his dad, Carl Reiner. But the last few years of Carl Reiner's life, this is, I'm sure you probably know this, but apparently every night he would just go to Mel Brooks's house and they would just watch old movies or old TV shows or whatever, and like just hang out.
Yeah.
Like, how fucking incredible is that? So I'm in with, or I guess maybe not in, but I do. I just rewatched my yearly Love Actually rewatch.
Ah, and, yes.
In light of everything with Rob Reiner, and actually, I think I was watching it when you texted me. And I was thinking about it afterwards, and when all this stuff came out about his son possibly being involved. I don't want to, you know, condemn the man yet. It does seem like that's what happened, though. One of the storylines in Love Actually that doesn't really get the weight I think it deserves is with... what's her name?
Laura Linney. Yeah.
Who is responsible for her brother, who has some mental issues, is having to live in an institution, and what it's done to her life, and how she just quietly accepts it and still continues to show up when he says he needs her, deals with abuse, probably verbally and clearly physically. And it's just, it's this kind of like unsung love. You know, I, a lot of people would point at that and just be like, that's foolish, you know, and part of me agrees with that. You know, it's hard to disagree with like derailing your own life and your own happiness because of a familial bond. But I, there's something to be said for that. You know, that that's a strength that a lot of people just don't have. And, you know, not that they were in the poorhouse or anything, but I mean, Rob Reiner did. Like, he was an activist for his son. He was a supporter for his son. He, you know, now whether his son will ever be able to see that, or if he didn't, I mean, I'm sure at some point in time, things were said that, you know, maybe you can't take back by both sides. But you know, it's one of the things, it's also one of the reasons why, especially with drug and alcohol addiction, I know it's like, I try to tell my mom this too. I know that that's your child. I know you love them. Here's the problem. Even if you are a very good person, like Rob Reiner seemed to be, my mom can be toxic as hell. She'll never hear this, so I can say that. even if you're this good, noble person, you're part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, because
your family, that's where it starts. Something happened, even if it's just, you know, in your genes, you know, you're missing something. Like, it still stems, like, you're never going to be able to help in the way you want to be able to help.
Yep. It's like, it's codependency in a way that codependency is like it's impossible to get around. Like, you know, it's that whole thing of like, it's your child. But in a lot of ways, like everybody that has ever gotten clean that I've known in my life said that everybody had to leave them. Like, they literally had to bottom out. That was including their parents turning their back on them.
Now, you can come back to that once you know how to deal with that, you know, some trauma is worse than others, but we've all got familial trauma. Even the people with what we would think were charmed lives all have familial trauma. So once you know how to deal with all that, or even that you don't have to deal with it, it becomes easier to come back to. But like, living in it and trying to get healthy, it's damn near impossible. And, you know, I'm not throwing blame. It's just that's, you know, it's so, and seeing this outcome is just so fucking just horrible and tragic for somebody that, you know, we thought the absolute world of, you know, and was by all accounts just a very good person. And, you know, it's just sad, sad world. So, let's move on to happier stuff. You want to talk about some trailers?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about one that I don't even know if I want to say happy. So I'm gonna go on a rant and the fucking Doomsday trailer. Are you kidding me?
Oh my god. Like, yeah.
first, let me say one positive thing. I wish that this is the way we would do trailers again, like the actual tease. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, well, you didn't tell me anything. The problem I have is the hype about it, which maybe Marvel / Disney was not really the people hyping it, but they definitely were not quite like. I would have liked to see the Russos be like, guys, calm down. It's not going to be what you think it is. Like, something. Because the spoilers for the Avengers Doomsday, is it even 30-second teaser? Steve Rogers will return in Avengers Doomsday. I almost said Endgame.
Well, also, like, Steve Rogers Jr. I mean, like, what the fuck, dude? Like, really?
I mean, there's a lot to speculate there. Like, what is the baby? Like,
yeah.
is it his baby? Why is Peggy not with him? Why does it say Steve Rogers will return and not Captain America? Is that because the Falcon is Captain America, so he's not going to be Captain America? Or is it because he's Steve Rogers and Steve Rogers was not Captain America in what we're watching? Maybe he's not a good guy. Maybe he's a bad guy. Like, I like all the questions that come with that. I like that it's a teaser in the way that, like, remember the original Independence Day teaser where it was just like,
yes,
just the ship coming to Earth or, and it was just like July 4th. And we're like, what the fuck is that? Like,
or Robin Hood. Do you remember Robin Hood?
Yeah.
The Costner one with the arrow. Like, it got so popular that they had to put it into the movie. But I mean, like, yeah, like I like it. I like it that it's a true teaser, but like you said, the hype machine made it such that we thought we were getting a trailer, but then we started to find out the other thing, which I know that you're going to get to now, which is it's so crass because how many trailers are supposedly out there now? They're going to be four, right?
Yeah, like, four, I think.
One with
it's the ending of fucking Clue or something. Like,
yeah.
Go see this and you'll get this ending. Go see this and you'll get that whole thing just kind of bummed me out. I mean, you didn't need a trailer to drive ticket sales for Avatar. So
no.
That you could only see it with Avatar is a little weird to me, because like it certainly wasn't playing in front of SpongeBob, because we'll get to this in a minute. I did go see the beginning of SpongeBob so I could see the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles short.
I didn't get to see because we're recording this because we're recording this on Friday, I wasn't able to go see that because the Thursday showing was at 7 o'clock at night for SpongeBob. Yeah. Like, what the hell, dude? Why is there Avatar things at 2 o'clock, but not SpongeBob? Anywho, but we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about that.
There was no Avengers trailer in front of that. So, those were probably the two big openings this weekend. Certainly the two biggest. So it's probably not playing in anything else that opened new this weekend.
No.
So, yeah, it's weird to me to have this short of a teaser trailer. Like, I use the Independence Day just because, in my mind, that's the biggest tease for something from my childhood that I can remember. Because I was watching the Super Bowl and saw that trailer. I was like, what the hell is that? Like, what is this going to be? And, like, it just amped everything up. I saw that on television, which I know back then we didn't have the internet, but, like, I didn't have to go to a movie theater to see it. It played in movie theaters, but I saw it on TV. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, why is – you could have put this online. And, yeah. And it probably would have been better for you.
And you probably would have owned the internet for a bit. And so here's the thing. Like, this is also brings up another, for me, this also brings up another problem, which is, and this is something that, like, I listened to Van and the guys, shout out to them. Like, they did a great Avatar, like, you know.
I haven't listened to it yet. I'm going to listen to
man.
It
this week. So. Get, buckle up. It's going to be, it's going to make you laugh. Because, like they go... They go hard. And also, like, they talk about, like, there's something that made me laugh so hard because they watched it at the same time that that the Ringer Film Podcast did. And so there's a moment where Van had actually turned around at Amanda and Sean and said something to them. That made me laugh. Like, I was like, that motherfucker. And I, like, you know, like, if you listen to the Midnight Boys enough, you know that Van is probably really like the way that he is.
Oh, yeah.
That he says he is. But anywho, but they also, they brought up a really good point, which is, so what Marvel is basically telling you guys, telling us all, is, all right, bro, we know we fucked up, but we're gonna make it right. And, you know, there's a lot of us that doesn't, that don't want them to make it right. Like, I don't, there's a part of me.
I don't need any of this back. I don't need this. I don't need Steve Rogers back. I didn't need Robert Downey Jr. in whatever fucking thing he's doing.
Exactly.
I still don't really think it's Victor Von Doom. I think it's a trick and it's going to be like evil Tony Stark.
Stark, yeah.
Like, I don't fucking need any of that. Like, you forgot how to tell good stories. Like, that's the it became the spectacle. Like, good stories leading into the spectacle was wonderful. Then it just became the spectacle. Like, I think Spider-Man might be the only franchise that still kind of gets it, and I guess we'll see with the next movie. Mm-hmm. But, like, those stories still have, like, this grounded thing to them. Where they're absolutely about the character who's in a spectacular situation. And it's just they lost that along the way. And you know, I don't know. They're not willing to take lesser.
No. Like,
if you don't spend a shit ton of money and make Shang-Chi, and, you know, it's not their fault that it came out when it came out and nobody was going to the theater. But, like, if you just accept that it's going to be a mediocre showing, but then you commit to these new, they're also not committing to the new characters. They,
no.
You know, it's just a fucking problem. And yeah, it does bum me out that Steve Rogers is back because I didn't want him back. The only hope I have is that it's like, oh, it's evil Steve Rogers.
Steve Rogers,
but honestly, in the world we currently exist in, where Homelander is somebody that, you know, these dudes look up to as, you know, and aspire to be somebody like Homelander. Like, yeah, Homelander's awesome. Like, that's who we need. I don't know if we should have evil Captain Hydra or whatever, because they're just gonna turn him into a fucking hero. Like, it's the whole thing is just kind of like, I appreciate the little teaser, but the whole thing just kind of bums me out.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, I'm done with, like, I'm just, like, it, like, this is all, like, you know, like, I like you said, I'm for Spider-Man. I'm definitely, like, Spider-Man Brand New Day, like, I'm very excited to see what they have in store for us. I'm, the prospect of having a PG-13 Punisher, I don't know if I'm really, I'm kind of like,
He said he's done. Like,
yeah.
he's in Spider-Man. They're doing that special, and he said he's done with the Punisher. Like, I mean, everybody else has said they've been done before too, but I don't know, something from John Bernthal feels way more. It feels weird to be like, I think he has more morals than Robert Downey Jr., but
yeah,
like I kind of do. Like, he feels like the kind of guy who's like, well, I said I was done. I just don't want to do it anymore. You know, like yeah. He doesn't, for whatever reason. So I'm with you on the, like, I don't know about a PG-13 Punisher. But it, am I wrong? Like, I'm trying to think. He's the only character that has three good films. Solo films, at least.
Yeah.
Well, no, Captain America. Sorry. Him and Cap.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to take Civil War as a solo film because it's not a solo film.
It's a side adventure Avengers movie. I don't care what they say. It is a side Avengers. It's an Avengers adjacent movie. So realistically, they've only done two Captain America movies, and then they've done Steve Rogers, like, Avengers. And yeah, he's the only one. Spider-Man is the only one that's as three consistently good. I would say that in Guardians, but I know how you feel about Guardians, the first two Guardians.
I think Guardians 2 is better than Guardians 1. Mm-hmm. So I would say that those are, they're at least consistent. But like, I think Spider-Man Homecoming is a better all-around film than the first Guardians. I know people disagree with me, but.
I think they're on equal footing. But anywho, that's neither here nor there. For me at least. But also, like, I feel like they're going in the wrong direction. Like, ultimately, for me, this trailer had, like, was in direct opposition to the other trailers I saw when I was watching Avatar, because it almost feels like it was a step backwards.
Yeah.
Because, like, I saw two other trailers that I was not expecting to be anything, but I was blown away by because of the fact that it promised me something that I feel like we have been missing in spectacle. And we'll get to that in, like,
let's jump to it. Disclosure Day, I assume, was one of them.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I saw.
Can I make one negative comment about this?
Sure, sure.
That's a bad title.
It is. It, like, I don't know why it's called Disclosure Day. Even if I do know, and it's a part of the plot, which I think it is, it's still...
Why don't you call it D-Day?
Yeah, but also I think that Spielberg would feel like it's an insult to D-Day.
Right. And you don't go with just Disclosure because I know that there's an old movie with... is it Demi Moore and Michael Douglas, maybe? Yeah, called Disclosure, but like... That's been so long ago. You can't possibly conflate the two. So I don't know. I don't like the title. The trailer is fucking intriguing. Maybe we talked about this briefly when we talked about Wake Up Dead Man last week, but
yeah,
I was not prepared for coming off like, who the fuck is Josh O'Connor? Oh my God, this kid is incredible. Oh my God, he is like such a great actor. I need to see him in more things, to showing up in the theater this week and getting a trailer for the new Spielberg movie that fucking stars Josh O'Connor.
Yeah. Like, literally, he is the lead in this movie. Like, he is the lead. Like, not even Emily Blunt is the lead in the movie. Like, she's like a co-star, but I guess like what looks like a featured showy role, of which I'm all for. this movie, the trailer is so effective because, like, I think I was talking to you offline about it. And what's so effective to me about it is that it's Spielberg merging his three different selves into one, like, Spielberg. And we've only seen this done one other time before, and it was for what I feel like is arguably his best movie of the second half of his career, which I feel like the 2000s is what denotes his time frame. Like, there's pre-2000s, and then there's post-2000s. After he does, I feel like after he's done, like, he did Saving Private Ryan in 98, that's it. Like, that's the time where it like, literally the second half is, like, going into a different thing because it's right before 9/11, and then he makes what I feel like I said, what I feel like arguably his best film of the post 2000, which is War of the Worlds in, like, what, 2005?
Yeah.
I feel like that is arguably his best movie of this era, and it feels aping that.
If the ending were better, I would agree with you. I think the end of that movie is not good.
I don't mind the ending, because Spielberg has always had a problem with endings, because he wants to end things so nicely. Like, it's like Minority Report's ending ends worse to me than War of the Worlds.
I'd need to rewatch Minority Report. I barely remember. Like, other than the plot of the movie, like, I barely remember most of it. I remember War of the Worlds so much because I was, like, that movie was almost headache-inducing. It was so tense.
Yeah.
And just getting to the end of, like, oh, here's the street that, and that's where you're ending. I just felt so... I don't know, just nothing. And I don't know how you're going to end something like that, because it is like, you know, you either have to, I mean, I guess you end it like War of the Worlds ends, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, they all die because of American disease but you are telling, like, this one family story in that world. You're not doing Independence Day. You're doing a story in that story.
Yes.
So maybe I need to rewatch it and reassess it. I just remember walking out of the theater going, like, man, there are parts of that movie that will stick with me for, like, the choice. Like, do you kill this man to save yourself and your children? And, like, that's rough, and that's has stuck with me. But I just, like, the ending, I just remember being like, what? Like, okay. he got to in this, like, it's not even his house, right? It's like his ex-wife's house or something.
Yeah, it's his ex-wife's house in Boston. Yeah.
I was like, okay, that's where you're ending this, like, I guess. But yeah, I need to rewatch that. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, this does feel like classic Spielberg. I texted Spencer and apparently said something out of line, because I said something about having not enjoyed a Spielberg movie in quite a while. And he was like, he said something about... West Side Story. And I was like, really? He was like, you need to watch West Side Story.
Yeah.
Which you've told me that too, but I'm like, I've seen West Side Story. Like, okay, whatever. But yeah, Spencer was just like, yeah, no, you really need to watch that. I was like, yeah, Adam says it's good too. But West Side Story. Like, what is he going to do? But I think we may have talked about it when we talked about Wicked. Anyway, that's whatever. This trailer looks, I'm interested to know what the other trailer you saw that that you're like, this is a masterpiece. I can't wait. Was it The Odyssey?
Yeah, it was The Odyssey. Okay. Like, I was genuinely surprised.
It's 6 minutes, right?
Yes, it's the opening. So, like, the best part about it is that the only person that talks is John Bernthal in that goddamn New Yorker accent that he has. Like he does in the first trailer. And the funny part is that it's literally classic Nolan fucking with time, because it starts off with Tom Holland looking at Tom Holland says nothing. It's all fucking Bernthal. I love the fact, dude, I really do love this choice of having Bernthal with his New Yorker accent, because he literally sits there and goes, do you know the story? Do you know the story? You don't know the story. So let me tell you, because I was there. Like, literally, it's something out of, it almost feels like they're on a stoop in Brooklyn. And he's like, let me tell you about your dad in Afghanistan, motherfucker. Like, it's like a weird kind of, it starts like that, but then.
I like that they're not putting on airs. Like, yes. I can really, really appreciate just going with the, like, this is the way. Everybody's going to speak the way they want to speak, basically, so that we can all understand them. And it's not, you know, flowery, you know, or some kind of like old English speak, or, you know, exactly. That he's not doing that. So,
no. And so then what ends up happening is that you get the opening moment with the Trojan horse. And I will tell you, like, I was like, when I was hearing like film bros talk about it, I'm like, sure, whatever, guys, whatever. You guys are fucking in the bag for Nolan bros. Fuck you guys. I don't care. No, they're right. Like, it's framed very much like the way that the Dark Knight Rises opening 6 minutes was. Where you get the scene and then you get a trailer-esque trailer. Like, it's like a teaser. It gives you other additional scenes from the film. Nolan working in the same kind of tension that he did with Dark Knight. It has that discordant score, but it's also built to ratchet up the tension. And how can I put this? That opening moment, it's smaller scale than you expect it to be, because it's not thousands of people. It's not even hundreds of people. It's like 50 or 60 people. But in the way that it's shot, in the way that IMAX works, and the score and the sound design, it's effective, and it makes it feel personal, and it makes it feel super close. And this is going to be a movie that's PG-13, but I guarantee you, if anybody else had directed it, it would be rated R, because it's going to be that whole impactful thing and that intensity that Spielberg does with certain things.
Yeah.
But it's Nolan. So it's like, you know how, like, I feel like The Dark Knight Rises is like literally an R-rated film that got a PG-13. Because if it's not Christopher Nolan, you're literally an R-rated film because of everything that it deals with. It deals with like mass rape. It deals with it shows a graphic backbreaking in the movie. It's violence is like, I don't know if the last time you've seen The Dark Knight Rises, but
I haven't seen that movie since it came out in theaters, because I walked out of that going like, ugh.
Yeah, it's an ugly film. And there's no way that movie should actually be PG-13, but it is, right? I feel like in that same regard, it feels like The Odyssey. Like, when you see the trailer, when you see that preview, you go, yeah, I now see what, like, this is an R-rated movie parading around as a PG-13 movie. Like, that's the tone that it gives. It's effective. Like, And it made me think about, in a weird way, it took me back to like the first time I saw something like Conan. Does that make sense? Like how yeah. dangerous and real world and earthy it was? That's the way that The Odyssey feels. Like that's the biggest comp I can give it, is that it feels like the original Conan the Barbarian. Not Conan the Destroyer, guys, but the original Conan. It felt dangerous. It feels grounded. It doesn't feel like these epics that we've seen, like Troy, where there's millions of people and it doesn't matter. It mattered more to me seeing 50 or 60 people going at each other in this movie, like in this 6-minute trailer, than anything I've seen before, because I knew every single one of those people was a real person. And that goes back to something that I was going to say before, that Avengers Doomsday does not have, which is, I think that this year with like my favorite movies, it was like kind of like going back and looking forward to 2026, is that there are a lot of movies out there that are starting to go back to a groundedness that I think, like, it's the Die Hard, it's the Die Hard dictum, where we were like big muscles and all this shit in the 80s, and then Die Hard happened and everybody was like, nah, motherfucker, we're going back grounded. We're going to the groundedness. And I feel like One Battle After Another and Sinners, which were two movies that were big in human emotion, but in scale, they were about things that like were small scale. Like it was about a father and a daughter. Yeah. It was about two brothers.
Well, and the event was, it was not earth shattering. It was not like we've got to save the world. It was very small scale event. Like, yeah, vampires can be earth changing, but it's dealing with like this community, you know? And I mean, honestly, that's, there's a whole Michael Scott rant in an episode of The Office where he talks about where Die Hard goes wrong is when it becomes not the small, it's when he's saving the world. That's when you're just like, this is, you know, this is just ridiculous. And where you're with John McClane is when he's running around without shoes on, like inadvertently fighting, you know, thieves disguised as terrorists. Like that level of thing. I'm excited for The Odyssey. Like weirdly, I mean, I thought Oppenheimer was okay. I still haven't seen Tenet. Like, I'll probably get to it before I watch The Odyssey, just so I can be on the, like, yes, I've seen every Christopher Nolan movie. I think that and Following are the only ones I haven't seen. So
Following is a snooze, man.
I owned it at one point, and I tried to watch it, and I probably made it like 15 minutes in, and I was like, what's the Richard Linklater film that Kevin Smith is always going on about?
Slacker.
Yeah, Slacker, same thing. Like, I watched it, and I'm like, okay, I watched 15 minutes of the movie. Like, I see what you're doing. I see, but I'm not going to watch even 90 minutes of this.
Exactly.
I'm jealous that you got to see that, but it's okay because I offset you, because I did get to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles,
yes,
Chrome Alone in New York. The Chrome Alone thing was really confusing to me because I was like, I don't understand Chrome Alone. Like, other than the pun of
Home Alone. Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense when you see it.
Okay.
I want to talk about it without spoiling a single fucking thing, because I want you, when you do get to see it, to just be howling. Like, I don't want you to know anything that's coming.
Well, I'm seeing it today. So we could always do like a special. We could do a special, like, you know me. Any chance to talk about turtles? What did I send you this week? Like, I haven't even seen the fucking movie, but a friend of mine for my, like, this tells you how much I'm a Turtles fan. A friend of mine got me an early Christmas gift, told me to come over, and I didn't even tell you the context in which I got it. He was like, come over, I got a gift for you. And he's like, I think you'll like it. I think I've topped you this year. Because we're always competing for, like, gifts and stuff. Like we always find each other, like, the, like, we try to find each other not the most expensive gifts, but the most personality-driven gift that you could get for the other person. He's a huge Seinfeld fan, right? So, like, 2 years ago, I got him the puffy shirt. I got him an exact recreation of the puffy shirt.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. To which this year he wore to Halloween as Jerry in the puffy shirt. But anyways, so like this year he was like, I think I topped you. And I hadn't gotten him his gift yet. I know what I'm going to get him now. And I know that he occasionally listens to this. So I'm not going to disclose that, at least on air. But so like I come over to his house and he's like, there it is. And it's just a box. Like it's a box. Like it's a brown box. And he's like, I didn't bother to wrap it. He's like, but you got to open it. I open it and it's literally, it's the perfect way to open it because I got the knockout. He got me all four of the turtles that are the knockout dual packs. And it just came in a box. And he was like he later told me that they're not out at Target. You have to actually, you'll see them at, like, if you want to go to Target, and I don't go to Target. So thankfully he got it for me. He's like, but you'll see the shelf, and the shelf will be empty where they are, where they're supposed to be. Don't think that they're not there. Part of the deal is you have to ask somebody because they've been told not to put them out.
When you watch it, like, a lot of that will make sense. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely hysterical. It has me stoked for the new movie, which we won't get for two more years.
Years, yeah.
I don't know about this GOAT movie that's coming out, but Sony Animation is operating on, like, the next level.
They really are. They're hungry. You can tell the animation is such that, like, it wasn't good enough for them. Like, they're not sitting on their laurels just because of Spider-Man, right? Like, K-pop Demon Hunters is from them. Anyways, go ahead. Go.
I don't want to say too much about it because I want you to to see it in all its fucking glory. Just that it's absolutely wonderful. It's worth, I don't know how good the SpongeBob movie is because we didn't wait around to watch it, but it's worth it, like, especially if you have like A-list,
yeah,
to just be like, yeah, I'm gonna book a ticket for that and then go sit through that Ninja Turtles short. I will say, since I'm talking about that, season two of Tales of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is out on Paramount Plus.
It is
dropped in its entirety. I've watched the first three episodes. It's fucking great.
Okay.
It continues the legacy that they've set up with that first movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's still funny to have Splinter not speaking and just talking in the rat thing. And it's gotten to where the turtles are just like, why won't you just talk? the joke is they're not going to pay Jackie Chan to voice the character, and rather than bring in another voice, they're just having him speaking like little squeaks and stuff. There's some really, really fun guest stars. Like I said, I've only watched the first three episodes, but if you have Paramount Plus, it's worth checking out for sure. The first season was a lot of fun. I wasn't going to watch it. Adam convinced me to watch it. But both of those things. And we found out, since we're talking about Sony Animation, we found out this week that Sony purchased a controlling stake in the Peanuts intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So they now have a big say-so in the Peanuts franchise, as it were. We've not seen much from Apple, right?
Yeah.
In regards to the Peanuts, they kind of have the broadcast, right? And they've done a couple of shows, I think, but nothing to like any really big acclaim. So I'm kind of sort of a Peanuts fan. Steph is a really big Peanuts person. So for people that do enjoy those characters, in this world of like ever like changing hands with IP and like it does get a little frustrating, but a company that's trying to do something like new and inventive, but also more traditional, like maybe this is a really good thing.
No, I think that it is. Like, I really liked the Peanuts movie from, I think it was 2015.
Yeah, I was going to say it's about 10 years ago because I saw that movie in the theater in Atlanta. I was going through radiation at the time, radiation treatment, and I walked to the theater because it was close by and sat through the Peanuts movie. Because I was like, I don't have anything else to do. So, yeah, that's been over a little over 10 years ago. So, yeah, it's been a decade.
Yeah. And I liked it. I liked the fact that it was unconventional. It was really cute. Yeah, it was an unconventional rom-com. Like, I was not expecting that. I really liked the entry point. I'm actually really sad that Blue Sky never got a chance to really to do something more. Yeah, because, like, literally it was released in the wake of the Disney takeover. Like it was already 2 years into the Disney takeover of whatchamacallit, and it was already in production, so they knew they did not stop it was the last Blue Sky movie, I think it was like actually the last Blue Sky movie before they stopped it, before they stopped like making it, because Disney, right? Which is interesting. It actually, you know what? I take that back. I think Spy in Disguise is the last one that they did.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, but it's not as good as the Peanuts. Like, I was actually genuinely surprised by that one because it got the tone right. Because like with Peanuts, it's always about the tone, right?
That's the one thing that makes me a little nervous is that like, you have some exec who's like, we got to bring them into the modern day. And it's like, that's where you're going to lose people, man. Like, if Charlie Brown starts talking about Skibidi Toilet, like, I'm out.
Yep.
You know? It's like, I don't want, like, it can't be modern slang. It's like, these are children with the souls of 75-year-old Jewish people. Yeah. Like, that's the Peanuts. Like, that's Charles Schulz. I'm hopeful for it. And like I said, it's like coming off the Ninja Turtles thing and the new season of their show. And like, I don't think, like, if you've seen the trailer for Goat, that's animation-wise, visually, that's a very interesting trailer. Like, there's a lot of kinetic stuff in it. There's a lot of interesting like mashing of styles in it, very Spider-Verse-y, but like nothing about that story interests me at all.
Yeah. Absolutely right. Like
it is because I have no affinity for basketball, but I don't know, man. It doesn't. Something about animated sports stuff doesn't really interest me.
I'm there with you. Like, I'm a huge basketball fan, but it just doesn't work. Like, for me, it just doesn't work. Like, I'm like, okay.
Is it because we like sports and we love a good sports story, real or fake, but I need the human connection.
Yes.
And I'm so when you put sports in an animated thing, for some reason, I instantly disconnect.
Oh, no, like, you're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't work for me. It does not work.
I want to watch that Pixar show that's on Disney Plus about the sports, the baseball team. Yeah, exactly. But I'm like, animated sports stuff never works for me, man. It just never does.
It's not. Oh, God. Like, I wish I could tell you something different. I wish I could be like, oh, no, this will change your mind. Not really, dude. It's not that great. It's not even it's just, it gets baseball. It's just, like you said, it's the human element. It's like, it's really kind of like, I don't know. Like, for me, it's like, and we're going to be talking about something that's actually like super animated. That's super, like, it's all animated, right? Like, nothing is real in this fucking thing. But, like, for this, like, you're right, like, the sports thing, there has to be, like, there has to be a human element to it for me. Like, that, like, it truly is something that I need to connect to on a human level. And if I don't get that, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Like, the whole purpose of a sports film is to see, like, is to have that suspension of disbelief that these people can do this thing, right? Especially,
and also because you've watched sports in real life, and like I don't know if you watch. I didn't watch last night's game. I read about it though.
Oh God! The stupid lateral pass, like. The refs were given that game to Seattle. They were in Seattle. Like, it really did feel like when you watch it, that reverse, like what they say was a reverse lateral pass. Man, they must have really liked Sam Darnold. I don't like Sam Darnold. I don't like the Seahawks. It was to me, it was a bullshit call. But you know what? I'm not a fan of the Seahawks. And it's like, it's one of those things where only in sports could you see something like that happen. If it was made up, so
when you, and even if you're making up that story, like, because we've seen the crazy sports stuff, like, we're into it when it's live action, but when it's animated, like, it's just a disconnect, and like, that's unfortunate. I mean, again, stylistically and like visually, the goat thing looks pretty incredible. Like, that's impressive, man.
Yeah,
but the story, you lose me, but Zootopia, I'm all in on, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, this is great. So, you know, anthropomorphic creatures solving crime. Okay. Playing sports ball. No, thank you.
An interspecies relationship between a fox and a bunny. Sure. Why not? Even though it makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
I totally get you on that.
Maybe that's why Space Jam doesn't work for me, because like the only thing I really love about Space Jam is like Bill Murray's like 5 minutes and the soundtrack. Everything else, I'm just like, yeah, I don't really care about this. So anyway, before we get to the main course here, I do want to very briefly, because I saw it last Saturday after we had recorded, did go see the re-release of The Shining in IMAX. I haven't seen The Shining in quite a while.
I did see your Letterboxd review.
I'm going to say something controversial. I don't understand why the fuck people love this movie, man. I understand, like, the filmmaking is incredible. But here's the thing, though. Like, every person in that movie... let me word it like this. Nobody in that movie is in the same movie. They're all in different movies. And it's not a lot of actors in the movie, but like, and I'm watching, I was like, wait, so I forget how little of the concept of The Shining is in The Shining. Like, there's nothing there. If you don't know, like, if I didn't know that world, that Stephen King stuff, all of that shit would make no fucking sense to me.
No, absolutely.
Not a single bit of it. And it's weird because we just got the Welcome to Derry finale, which was a mixed bag. But coming off of that, and I heard other people say this as well, Chris Chalk's performance, like, give me the Dick Halloran prequel series. Like, give me that, man. Because, holy shit, he's fucking incredible. And, like, it adds so much weight to that character. And then going and watching The Shining, I was just like, what? It's, I don't know, man. I don't get it. I really, really don't get it.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Did you read The Shining before you actually saw the movie?
Oh. Years before I saw the movie.
Okay. So I'm going to give you a distinction here. I love the movie The Shining. I did not read the book before I saw the movie. I saw the movie before I read the book.
And that's probably true of most people, right?
Yeah. That's what I think the big delineation is that most King fans that I know that read The Shining hate the movie.
Because it's just, there's nothing there, man. Like, other than like a disturbing performance, but Jack Nicholson is disturbing the minute you see him on screen. And that's like, Jack is not a disturbing character. Like, that's the whole point, you know? I don't think it's a bad movie. And I wouldn't even say that I hate it, but like, literally left the movie and was like, I just want to go home and watch Dr. Sleep now. Because I do think that Dr. Sleep is a better movie than The Shining. Sue me.
That's a bold take, but I like it. I like it a lot. The Shining isn't my favorite Kubrick, but it's up there. And for me, it's about the negative spaces in the movie. And there's all that movie is about negative space. And it's about a vibe. It is not
the
it
most is, effective thing in that movie is him riding the tricycle through the hallways. It is fucking unnerving, man. Yep. Like, it is the perfect marriage of like anticipatory horror, sound design, and visuals. Like, every corner that, like, it's so weird to praise this, but that sound of like carpet, hardwood floor, carpet, hardwood floor, like, it is unnerving. And every time he whips around a corner, like, you're just waiting for something horrible. And it's just that is that movie. I'm not gonna say like, oh, I wish it didn't exist. That like the wild ass conspiracy theories surrounding The Shining make it more fun for me. Like that makes it a more interesting movie. The movie itself, I don't think is actually that interesting or good beyond being like a well-made film with actors who were all in a different movie because none of them are in the same movie. Since we're talking about Kubrick and about to talk about Avatar, a good bridge for that is, did you see the interview with Sigourney Weaver? I don't know what the question was, but she talked about 2001 A Space Odyssey.
No.
She has never watched all of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Her response was essentially, every time I put it on, I can get through about 30, 40 minutes of it. And then I turn it off and go, nope, maybe next year.
That is great. That is rage bait. That is rage bait, dude. I love this.
It made me laugh so much because, like, I have an almost exactly similar relationship to 2001 where I tried to watch it so many times, like from like late teenager, like into my 20s. And then I think I saw it like maybe in my late 20s all the way through for the first time. And I'm pretty sure at some point I fell asleep. I don't think I fully like grasped the movie. I'm pretty sure it got re-released and maybe in IMAX, like maybe 8 or 9 years ago. And I may be misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure Spencer and I went and saw it. Mm-hmm. And I think I had a better understanding of like what he's trying to get at. Maybe not always successfully, but certainly like I understood the movie more. And was able to appreciate it, at least from a technical standpoint. Like, holy shit, man. Like, we can't make a movie now that looks that good. Like, I don't understand how he did that. but that Sigourney Weaver is just like, yeah, I watched like 30 minutes of it. And I'm like, nope, maybe next year.
Which is like, I love that. I love the rage bait of it, that the queen of sci-fi has not seen like what is arguably like what many people consider the preeminent sci-fi movie of all time. Like, I just love that. Like that just proves to me that you don't need context to do anything great. You can still do the great thing. And I'm always like, I'm of the theory that you don't need to see everything. I'm a very populist. I mean, we both agree that you don't have to agree with everybody. You don't have to be a film snob to love film, but you do have to have love and opinions.
We have disagreed pretty largely on what everyone considers the best movies of the year this year.
Yeah.
Like I think you've fallen more in line with the critical consensus, and I'm way more. Who was that dude? They used to have him on the film cast sometimes, who was like built his career on just like disagreeing with critical consensus.
Oh, Armand White.
Yes, that guy. Like, I'm kind of like him, where I'm just like, yeah, this is not a good movie. I don't see what you see. Not to that level, because, like, I don't think Sinners is a bad movie. I didn't think Weapons was a bad movie. I don't think that One Battle After Another is a bad movie. I just don't think it's the movie that everybody else seems to think it is. So
and you're like, and that's the whole thing is that like I don't not disagree with you. And it's like, it's not like we have fights about this. Like, it's just, that's your opinion. Like, and like, I can't discount your opinion because, to be perfectly honest, that like, they're completely valid. Like, because it's a lot of
it. I greatly enjoyed Death of a Unicorn, and I'm pretty sure you did not like that movie.
No, not at all. Not in any way, shape, or form. Like, I just, like, if it was like, it was like a wannabe Knives Out movie. It was like with a unicorn. Like, but that's okay, because like, you know, we've talked about before, just because I have a difference of opinion or you have a difference of opinion doesn't make your opinion invalid or my opinion invalid or mine greater than your, like, you know, like, it's never like, I think that the reason why we're able to talk about these films is that we don't look at each other's opinion as invalid. Like, I look at your opinion and I go, yeah, you know what? He's right. Like yeah. when you talk about like Sinners, like, it's absolutely valid what you, like, your thoughts on it and your critiques about it and the whole twin aspect and it not being as much about the twins as it should be. Like, that's a valid critique. Like, and I cannot say that it isn't. Like, your thoughts about Weapons, completely valid.
Now, Weapons is one that I want to go rewatch to reconsider, because there is stuff in that movie that's kind of like lingered with me. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we've all had those movies where the first time you watch them, you're just like, eh. I mean, The Big Lebowski was a movie that the first time I had to sit through that movie three times before I made it all the way through the movie, because I didn't really, like, it just wasn't connecting with me. I didn't get what they were going for. But like, when I got it, I was like, oh, like, and now I'm kind of I'm with it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay, like, I understand this now. And there's stuff that stays with me from Lebowski. I think Weapons will fall into that category.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to revisit it, because it does have just these wild swings, and it operates in, like, the horror, the comedy, the drama, the suspense. Like, it's moving on so many levels that I don't think I was in the right frame to watch that.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, everything else felt more like, I get where you're going for, but it's not connecting with me, man. It's just not doing it. That's a good place to jump into. I get where you're going for, man, but it's not connecting with
yeah.
me. Let's talk about Avatar, Fire and Ash.
So we kind of, like, I kind of talked a little bit about my opinions about it, but now we can really get into the weeds with this fucking movie. I'd like to hear what you have to think about this movie, because, man.
Steph had never seen the second one. She'd seen the first one long, long ago, probably when it first hit home video.
Mm-hmm.
So she was very much on the, like, I got to watch the second one, and why don't we just do both of them? And I was like, that's a good idea. So over the last few weeks, we watched the first two Avatar movies. I hope that everybody that's going to see Avatar Fire and Ash did not rewatch the first two Avatar movies. Because really, you're just going to see a retread of the first two Avatar movies.
And to be perfectly honest, I don't think that people are going to see it. Let's be honest. Like, they're not going to go see it because they don't have the time. Like, yeah. And that's part of, like,
too fucking long. Like,
yeah, all of them are.
The second one, like, rewatching the second one, I was like, holy shit. Like, I get how visually stunning this is, but, like, give me the 2-hour Avatar movie, but then release in IMAX the Avatar experience.
Yep.
And let me pay $20 to go watch this 35-minute, like, deep dive through the world of Avatar with it's just the music and the visuals. Let me pay for that separately and just give me the Avatar movie. I want to see what happens with the Sullys, man. Like, I appreciate how much world building you've done, but the just languid, like, sitting in that world, Jesus. Like, we're going to spend 20 minutes, like, cameras floating through the... It's awesome. It's visually fucking stunning.
Yeah.
There's never been anything like it. There might not ever be anything like it again. Oh, my God, it's exhausting.
It really is. Like I told you, like, I think I had said it. I was like, visually, it is fucking stunning. Narratively, it is inert. Like, it is inert. Like, it is, it's like, we, like, and I understand why they're doing it, but it's like, the first hour, you're literally recapping the entire first two movies.
Have an ending that is the same ending as the very first film, only it's like, oh, this time instead of the forest creatures, it's the sea creatures. It's the same ending. And like, I get it. Like, where else were you going to go? Like, I don't know, man. I don't. Other than, like, this is a spectacle, I don't know what more it has to offer, because the things that it could spend time ruminating in and focusing, like, diving deeper in, it doesn't do that. It does that with the visual stuff. It doesn't do that with the, like,
the story.
These two people lost their child in war. And we get minutes of, just minutes in a 3+ hour movie of like, she's dealing with her grief this way, he's dealing with his grief this way. Like, and how are they going to reconcile to each other? You know, like, the blame of what happened, and or the father son relationship with the youngest son now, and there's just not a lot of time spent in that. And I think I'd be okay if it were right at 2-hour movie, like, oh, I get it. There's a lot here. And so you're kind of just having to keep the train moving. But in a 3+ hour movie, to not spend time in those things, I think does a disservice to those characters. But also, I'm not sure that James Cameron's ever been that good with character. Like, he's very George Lucas in that way.
The idea of it, you can't,
the nitty gritty you have trouble with.
Well, I mean, okay, and then let's be honest, like, if you want character, you go see Sentimental Value. You don't go to see Avatar, right? Like, he is the equivalent, like, I was talking to somebody about it, and, like, they it was Scott, and he was complaining about James Cameron's character work, right? And I'm like, well, you go to see a James Cameron film not for the character work. It's almost like John Ford. Like, John Ford was never known as a character, like, as a guy who does, like, with the exception of a few movies, he was not known to deal with characters. His movies were spectacle, big budget spectacle, like, instead of space whales and aliens and shit, he was dealing with cowboys and indigenous people. They used to call them something else, and I won't call them that. But yeah, like, and he like Lucas before him, they deal with broad strokes. And the thing is that I don't, like, for me, it's something that I have to turn my brain off with. Because if not, it bothers me so much. It, like, bothers me to the nth degree. Even this, the second... Okay, so I will tell you something. We can talk about the context in which I saw this... The first time I saw this on the Disney lot at their biggest... Like, they have three screening rooms. And they have an IMAX there, like a full IMAX that can play 70 millimeter. They have a Dolby Cinema that is like the most highest tech Dolby Cinema that there ever was. It's probably like, and that's where I saw it. And I saw it in the high frame rate, and I saw it in Dolby Atmos in 3D. And it was so, it was such a, like, it was such a overwhelming experience that I hyper-focused on the story because it was too overwhelming of an experience that I just kind of hyper-focused on, why the fuck are they doing this? Why are they doing that? It wasn't until this the second viewing in IMAX 3D, which I know sounds like it would be even more of a thing, but it wasn't because I'd already gotten through the story. So, like, all of my gripes that I was having in my head that first experience were gone, and I could just vibe on the movie, right? Because I have major problems with the story that is basically Avatar Part 2, Part 2, the remake.
Yeah.
That's literally what it is.
I'm completely with you, but, like, it's also the kind of movie, like, all three of them that, like, if I just needed something on my television in the background, like, if I had, especially if I had a fucking killer setup.
Yeah.
Like, in high def, it, like, just put it on, let the three of them run all day, and I'll just pop in and out. Like, it's great. It would be great because the vibe of the movie, in the parlance of our times, it's wonderful. Like, it is, I mean, it's not all happy, but it is, like, you can just kind of, like, come in and out of the movie and, you know, not really feel like you're missing something. I will say there is one scene in this movie that I think does actually have, like, they do spend the right amount of time in it. And that's when Neytiri and Jake escape with Spider.
Yes.
And Jake has come to the realization that, like, they know what Spider is. They know what he represents. And the only way to solve that problem is to kill this kid. Because they cannot protect him. Because the entire might of this government and this company will come for this kid because of what he now means. That's a hell of a fucking scene, man.
But, and this is the second time that I saw it, I'm going to tell you that, like, it got me that first time too, but then I realized, like, this is what I saw the entire time, was Spider going, okay, Lenny, look at I see the bunnies, they're great. They're great, the bunnies are great. I'm like, you literally ripped it off of Gates of Wrath.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, which... you know, it is in and of itself, like, just the, you know, a biblical story of the sacrificial son.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's anything new.
Yeah.
There's real, like, emotion there, which is pretty interesting because, A, the kid that plays Spider, we talked about him when we saw the second movie. He's not great. Like, no. He's okay. He's just not great. I know the story was already in play, but, like, given the reaction to Spider from the second film, it did feel like Cameron doubling down and saying fuck you to people who didn't like that character.
Who didn't like Spider, yeah. Like,
I'm going to make him the fucking focal point of the third movie. But his performance isn't great. I do think he's really pretty good in that scene.
But, oh, he is, yeah.
Like, the added weight of, like, this is, like, really emotional shit from people in mocap suits. Like, that's pretty incredible. You know, because it could come off as kind of, like, maudlin or goofy or, you know, think of like, I always compare the Avatar movies to like the world of Wizard of Oz because like, I don't know. It just feels like that to me. But like, think about like the lion and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow showing emotion in Wizard of Oz, which I get is supposed to be like played up in a little high.
Yeah.
But it could only ever come off as like goofy. And the, like, you literally have the Tin Man and the Scarecrow basically there in that scene showing like true real emotion. And I, like, that's the best scene in the movie from like a more traditional filmmaking standpoint, like from an acting standpoint, from how it's shot, from like, it really, really works. From an emotion standpoint, and it looks wonderful, but like everything else is so. I would argue that, at least for the two of us, probably for a lot of people, we don't enjoy Avatar for the story.
No,
like, I did enjoy the movie. Like, I had a good time watching the movie. It sounds like I'm being really negative about it, but like, if you go to my Letterboxd reviews of the first and second movies, it is literally like, this is a 2-star story and a 5-star visual feast, making it like a 3.5 or 4-star movie. Because the story is not, none of these stories are beyond a 2-star. Like,
oh, yeah, like, no, absolutely.
They're just not great stories because they're as basic as you could possibly fucking be. I do think the Quaritch one-liners in this are a little misplaced. They feel like added stuff.
Yeah. They also feel like, so like, and like, I know this is very crass, but it's Cameron getting high off his own supply. Like, it's him, because like, we all know that him and Stephen Lang get along like gangbusters. Like, he like really loves Stephen Lang, and it feels like this whole thing of like a, like, oh well, this is my time to be able to really show what Stephen Lang can do. And it literally came down to like, not really showing anything other than just kind of like, let's make him quippy like Arnold. Like he
yeah.
And it's like, it's also like some, like he, because he decided to make the Quaritch stuff, it also like, it also is some of the weirdest shit. Like the whole thing of like him getting high and him getting a girlfriend. So it's like, he comes back and he's like, hey, I'm just like Jake. I'm evil Jake because I have evil Neytiri.
Well, because like, you spend so little time, like, with the character investing into that, it feels off, and you know? Like, you just gotta kind of roll with it. And, like, also, Giovanni Ribisi is back. Like, they don't, like, he gets exiled in the first one, so he has to go back to Earth. So, and then, I guess, somewhere along the way, he turns around and comes back.
But it also, if you do the math, it works. Because it's been 12 years. Because
you're right.
And like, I was actually tracking that because his kids are teenagers. So it makes sense that it would be Quaritch would go, or Ribisi's character would go back to Earth, spend a couple of years there, and then come back. Right? Like, it makes sense. It tracks because Jake's oldest kid is like, I think he's like 17, 18. So it would make sense that they come back, and including what's her name, including the one, I can't think of her, like everything makes sense, like, because also the city is built up, so it's like a whole entire city now. But it's like, it's so weird because it's like the world building and the timelines are so wonky because he's dealing with real time, like real space travel. So it's like the entire story, if you think about it, has taken place over 18 years. Because
and it's weird because like There was a time jump between one and two.
Two, exactly. And
this is literally a fucking sequel. Like, yep. Which we know in hindsight because he talked about splitting two into two movies, and that's two and three. And so, yeah, of course it would be a direct sequel, but it is like... It, I guess partly because it's been a couple of years, I was like, oh, there'll probably be a little time jump. It's like, oh, wait, no, they're still with the water people and she's still pregnant. How long has this girl been pregnant? Like, it felt a little weird, but it did help that I had just watched the second one because I was like, oh, yeah, like I already kind of knew. Like some of that remembered. So I was like, oh yeah, the whales can talk to them. I forgot that, you know, stuff like that. The I will say that like the spectacle parts of this movie, mm-hmm. Holy shit, man.
Right. Like,
it's so fucking impressive. Like even something as small scale for this movie as like Jake's escape from the city. Like it looks fucking good, man.
This is weirdly enough, like his Star Wars. And, but at the same time, like it's the whole thing of like Cameron likes to go just one step further than Lucas. Like, do you know what I mean? Like Lucas is like, he's always been trailing Lucas, but with the Avatar films, he finally just went, okay, if I do my own thing, I can make my own thing. And yep. He basically has made his own version of a Star Wars film. And he's doing like the thing I feel like that separates him from Lucas is that Lucas for so long was trying to track the love. Like he was trying to chase the love of fandom. Whereas Cameron does not give a fuck.
Not give a not a single bit, man.
But he also is like, his brain works the way that fandom does because he's like, you know what I want to see? I want to see a dragon get chased by mechs in a fucking techno city. And you know what? I'm going to make people love this because like to me, that shit was wild. And I'm like, I did not know I needed a middle-aged dragon, like a Dark Ages dragon. Like I didn't know that I needed my Middle Ages like fantasy shit mixed in with my mech stuff. But he does it and it's like holy shit. And it does it with a level of realism with the animation, because this is not animation. Like, I know that a lot of people like to be crass about it and like, oh, it's just animated films. No, this is not animated films. Animated is what you watched when you watched SpongeBob.
Yeah, it's such another level of like, I mean, it's the stuff that Lucas was getting at.
Yes.
With the prequels that he could never actually fully get to. But God, man, like just things like when the general, I think she's a general. She comes out like those suits that they wear. It's like a mech suit, but it's really just so that they can like stand as tall as the Na'vi.
Yes.
Like that, it's just like, well, that doesn't exist. Like, it's just like a weird rig that they, like stuff like that, that's just insane. They have that weird transport vehicle that like the wheels move in like front.
Yeah.
In side directions. It's just crazy stuff that we talked about, you just sit and like chill and vibe with the movie and be like, oh, that looks cool. That looks cool. And just when you deep dive into the story, there's not a lot there. Just not a lot of pathos.
So no, like
it's all surface level stuff, you know?
Yeah. Like the main bad guy, like the Una Chaplin character, like her whole motivation is because Volcano took them and I need fire weapons. Like, it's so, like...
Yeah, they had a time of tragedy, and God didn't show up and save them. So
now they hate Ewa, and they want to burn the world. And it's like, okay, let's make this the most simplest villain, but then becomes, like, Quaritch's girlfriend after she, like she's, like, supposedly this, like marauder, right? And you would think that she wouldn't give a shit about, like, she would kill Quaritch, but, you know, after he goes on his spirit quest with, like, the Aaron Rodgers peyote, fucking, like, and she gets a couple of guns, all of a sudden she's his boo thing. And I'm like, wait, this doesn't make sense. Cameron, why are you writing these fucking scripts just to dictate the story that you want to tell? Let these characters do what they would naturally do, which is that she'd fucking kill Quaritch. That would have been an interesting, like, development, right? But we're talking about movies that are visually so complex that you need a storyline that is literally the baseline of storylines.
So you talked about the high frame rate. So, like, you can see this in, like, specifically 3D high frame rate. So I saw it in 2D. The high frame rate is there regardless.
Yes.
You're just not seeing it projected in high frame rate. And so, like, when the movie started, I could tell, like, the frame rate is a little... But it is bizarre how quickly... So, like, I saw... at least one of the Hobbits, I think the first Hobbit movie, in 3D and high frame rate, it was unsettling. Like, I was like, I don't know how anybody could ever watch a movie like this. But Cameron does it. Like, and I didn't see it projected in high frame rate in 3D, like his maximum stat, whatever. I just saw regular projection. But, like, after about 5 or 6 minutes, I was really into it. Like, it just felt more natural. Like, the first few minutes was really tough because I was like, they're moving. Like, I'm just visually, I'm not used to, like, the movements in high frame rate. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, once, like, the movie settles in, like, it really, really works. It is much like the first, I want to talk about another Cameron thing that we can end on. I enjoyed the movie. It is just like the first two. It's completely redux of the first two, like meshed together. I may see it again. I don't know. I'm not sure. I kind of want to go see it in IMAX so I can see the Odyssey preview.
Yeah.
So I may wind up going to see it again. But I'm sure it'll make the $1.5 billion, maybe $2 billion with the global box office. Like, it'll be huge in fucking China. I'm happy for him. Great. He stated that his next project is a Terminator film.
Yeah.
So he's going back to that well to try to write that franchise. Can he do it?
I never bet against James Cameron.
Yeah,
me either. I don't. Like, the only thing is if he's producing it, no, absolutely not. But if he's directing it, it means that he is. I always felt like he hated the fact that there are 5 Terminator films that are not directed by him and that they sullied the franchise.
Yeah, I think the further it went along, the more he regretted
letting not doing go 3. Of it. Yep.
Yeah, because, like, when 3 came, like, he's, like, basically, like I said, everything I wanted to say. Like, it's like, whatever, they're going to make a third one. That'll be the end of it. And then that wasn't the end of it. And then they rebooted, and then they rebooted the reboot, and then they had another reboot. And then, like, it became like, fuck, what did y'all turn this into? He has said Arnold will not be involved.
Yeah.
So he needs another Terminator. Stephen Lang that Terminator?
That's what I was going to suggest, is that I think, like, all you need to do is watch, like, if you watch the behind the scenes stuff with him and Lang, you could tell that Lang is his dude. Like, they're very simpatico. Like I feel like Lang is the right kind of old, like, why Stephen Lang never became a superstar in the 80s is beyond me. But I think that it, like, the only thing I can think of is that if Stephen Lang from 2009 was the Stephen Lang in the 1980s, he would have been as big as Charles Bronson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Bruce Willis combined. Because
I'm here for a Stephen Lang Terminator series,
man. Oh, yeah. I am, too.
I wanted this man to play Cable so badly after watching the first Avatar movie. I was like, yeah, that's Cable. That's Cable. Put him in an X-Men, or just make him Cable. He's fucking Cable. He's that guy.
Yeah, he is.
And so, like, whether he is the Terminator or he is part of the Resistance or, like, whatever, like, I think you can put that franchise on his shoulders, and with the right direction and the right script, like, really, really get something out of it. You know, I would be probably okay if Cameron only makes Avatar movies the rest of his life. It would be nice to have somebody, because, like, we've got somebody writing the Predator franchise, right? Like, mm-hmm. If we're going to keep having Predator movies, we've had somebody course correct that ship. We thought we had somebody course correcting the Alien ship. And it seems like there's still people trying to take that, you know, into places. We're just like, yeah, that's not what we're here for. But it's at least in a better place than it was after the fourth Alien movie. But, like, Terminator is, like, probably the other big franchise of our childhood that, like, got so off course. Now, I'll die saying that the Sarah Connor Chronicles was fucking brilliant, and, like, it sucks that the movie franchise destroyed that series, because it was doing the James Cameron work, you know? Yes.
No, like, absolutely. Like, we both agree on that. Like, that show was fucking, I own it. I own the first two. Yeah, the TV series. And, like, I'll put that on occasionally just because I like the vibe of that show. Like, like at least once every 2 years, I've gone back to it and watched the entire thing. Because I really like it.
That's why I fell in love with Lena Headey. So, yeah. Have him coming back to that and hopefully directing, like, I don't know. It made me, like, I was like, okay, this is okay. Maybe we're going to be okay in the Terminator franchise. Maybe not, but maybe we will. So, I guess we'll see. Go see Avatar.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to go see it anyway. If you're going to go see it, I would say all my IMAX screenings were 3D. If you can stomach the 3D, probably go see it so you can see that Odyssey trailer. I don't know what we're going to be talking about next. I'm actually out of town next weekend. We can talk about this on the podcast. Yeah. So next weekend, I guess we won't be able to record, which means we won't record again until the new year. Is that right?
About like, yeah, if you're gone next, well, this is Christmas, like next week is Christmas. And then the week after that is post Christmas. So like, if you're still out of town, then it won't be until the new year.
Yeah. So yeah, this was 2025, man. Like, we're ending on Avatar and the death of a beloved filmmaker.
Yeah. Which seems about right for 2025.
Yeah. That's. What a fucking year. So, but hey, you know, we are in both in agreement. I think that nobody had a better 2025 than Stephen King.
So. No, not really. Nobody did. I mean, maybe, no, I can't think of anybody. Like, nobody, like, at this point had the year that he had. He was basically the entertainer of the year because he entertained us so much with so much of his stuff. Like, and so much of it was just good content.
Yeah. You know? I mean, very little was, like, out and out bad. Like, I think The Institute is the only thing that, like, started bad and wound up okay. But everything else was, like, even The Running Man, as much as we didn't love the movie, like, it was still entertaining. So, which, you know, I think you can actually stream that now. I think it's on streaming already.
Yeah, it's available for download. To which I was like, oh, okay. That's sad. That it made no money. But I mean, you know, what are you gonna do?
Josh Brolin might be the close second to that.
Yeah, that's true. Like, that's very true.
Josh Brolin had an excellent fucking year.
He really did, didn't he?
So yeah, go check out everything else we do over at xwingfiles.com, or you can read our written work over at Adam's website.
Yeah, themovieowl.com, where we've got a ton of stuff coming out. I just got my copy for Black Phone 2, which that will be something I will be watching this weekend, along with Black Phone 1. Kind of perfect Christmas time thing, since it's a winter setting for that movie. I'm
so stoked to finally hear what you think about Black Phone 2, and if I'm off base.
No, I don't think you are, man. I'm super stoked for it, and I was in the bag for part one, so I've got that. I've got a bunch of 4K content coming out. I'm supposed to be getting the Monk box set in the next couple of days, so I'm going to be...
Nice.
Yeah, I'm going to be diving into, like that's another favorite show of mine, and I'll actually have a review for that hopefully by the new year, because I'm just going to be watching Monk for the foreseeable future, which I don't care. Like, that's like actually like to me,
Monk is excellent television. It's exactly good, like, put it on, laugh, maybe cry sometimes, like watch them be friends, get frustrated at each other. And like, it's just a good show. Like, that Monk and Psych were just like,
they really were.
I miss stuff like that. So, so I guess we will see you guys in 2026.
2026, guys. Star Wars, number 2 comics, number 3 Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, number 4 Mario, number 5 Weird Al, number 6 Batman, number 7 Kal-El, number 8 Simpsons, number 9 TV, number 10 every single band that has stole all their MP3s, but they're really all sold out. See it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything.